Isaiah 14:1-14:27, the 15th talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on June 27, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Chapter 14 today. I went to print my outline out this morning, and the printer is running out of ink, so if what I say sounds a little disjointed, it's because I can only read every other line of my outline. Let me remind you of a little bit of the how we've gotten to this point in Isaiah. The first five or six chapters, Isaiah was laying out his grand themes, the theme that Israel and Judah have been rebellious towards God, and that because of that rebelliousness, God is going to punish them. But it's going to be the kind of punishment, it's going to be a purifying punishment, a disciplining of them, such that some will repent of their wickedness, a remnant will remain, and of that remnant, God is going to make a great and holy people. So that those are the themes that are outlined in the first five chapters. And then he launches into a number of prophecies regarding this coming punishment on the nation of Israel and the nation of Judah. But interwoven with that is his prediction, prophecy of this coming righteous ruler. He doesn't call him the Messiah, but that's the term that we would apply to it. But then in chapter 13, we have a shift. And he begins to talk about the neighboring nations of Israel, those that have at one time or another oppressed Israel, that they have attacked, conquered portions of Israel, and oppressed the people that were living there. And in that section, it starts out talking about Babylon, which is very interesting because at the time that this is being prophesied, Babylon is a minor kingdom which is completely dominated by Assyria. So Babylon is barely a blip on the radar screen of history. How's that for a metaphor? But Babylon's barely there. It's not worthy of mention. And yet, what Isaiah prophesies here is the downfall of this great nation, Babylon. And we talked about that in chapter 13. In 14, now it continues talking about Babylon, and in a similar vein. And what it's in both 13 and 14, what it's talking about is this nation, which apparently is subsequently to when Isaiah is prophesying, is going to rise to some position of prominence in the world, real significance, a major empire. And that because of the arrogance of that nation, of the king of Babylon, that it is going to undergo a total collapse at God's action. So it'll be a dramatic fall. And this nation, which has been so mighty and so oppressive, is going to be justly punished. Now, it's interesting that in these two chapters, it does not highlight Babylon's oppression of Israel. What it highlights is Babylon's arrogance, its haughtiness. Now, the oppression is mentioned, but it is not highlighted. So what we have here is a story similar to many stories that we have all heard since childhood, like Cinderella or the Ugly Duckling, in which we have a character that is a good character, one that we sympathize with, and yet because of circumstances, its greatness is not recognized for a long time. And in fact, that person is picked on because they are seen to be lowly, insignificant. But in the end, that character is shown for the person or character that it truly is. And we are all happy at the end because justice has been done. That this character has finally met the true due coming to it, despite all of this period of time of suffering and pain because of a misunderstanding or a misapprehension of the situation. We have a similar kind of story here. Israel does not get its due until the end. Israel suffers and is not recognized as the people of God, the chosen people of God that it is, until the end. And in the end, those that have oppressed Israel are punished. There is a difference, though, in that this presentation highlights the arrogance of the oppressors and highlights the fall, then, of those oppressors, that they also get their due. So that's our story. We've got what appears to be an insignificant nation that suffers and in the end is shown for what it is and gets its due. And we have another set of peoples, but we'll talk just Babylon in particular here, which thinks that it is the greatest thing since sliced bread or something, and thinks it is really an incredibly powerful empire, unmatched, unrivaled. And it continues with that attitude until finally it falls and it meets its due, its just reward. Okay, let's look at this. Verses 1 and 2 of 14. When the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land, then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob, and the peoples will take them along and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord, as male servants and female servants, and they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors. So apparently a time is going to come. Isaiah is prophesying this at a time when Judah and Israel are facing imminent invasion. So times are not good in the land of Israel. But Isaiah is saying, a time will come when God will have looked down with compassion again, and he will choose the people again. Now, I think it's clear that he never did cease to have compassion for the people of Israel, and he never did cease to choose them. But it will be as if he is looking with compassion again, because it is as if he is not treating them with compassion during this period of punishment and travail that they are going to go through. So it will be as if God has abandoned them and then come back, smiling down upon them. When he does so, he is going to restore them to the land that God had promised Abraham. So keeping the promise that he had made. And they will be joined there by strangers, by foreigners. Now, this is a theme that comes up. This is the first time we've seen it in Isaiah, but it comes up a number of times in the future as we will go through the other chapters. And I would just like to read through some of those passages just briefly and with little comment. Isaiah 56, 3 through 8. It says, "Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, 'The Lord will surely separate me from his people.' Nor let the eunuch say, 'Behold, I am a dry tree.' For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, and choose what pleases me, and hold fast my covenant, to them I will give in my house and within my walls a memorial, and a name better than that of the sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name, which will not be cut off." Which will not be cut off. Was I going to read further? Yes. "Also, the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, every one who keeps from profaning the Sabbath, who holds fast my covenant, even those I will bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar. For my house will be called a house of prayer for all the peoples. The Lord God, who gathers the dispersed of Israel, declares, 'Yet others will I gather to them, to those already gathered.'" Let's also look at Isaiah 60, 10 through 12. "And foreigners will build up your walls, and their kings will minister to you. For in my wrath I struck you, and in my favor I have had compassion on you. And your gates will be open continually. They will not be closed day or night, so that men may bring to you the wealth of the nations with their kings led in procession." One more. "For the nation and the kingdom which will not serve you will perish, and the nations will be utterly ruined." And one more, 61, 4 through 7. "Then they will rebuild the ancient ruins. They will raise up the former devastations, and they will repair the ruined cities, the desolation of many generations. And strangers will stand and pasture your flocks, and foreigners will be your farmers and your vine dressers. But you will be called the priests of the Lord. You will be spoken of as ministers of our God. You will eat the wealth of nations, and in their riches you will boast." Gee. One more. "Instead of your shame, you will have a double portion, and instead of humiliation, they will shout for joy over their portion. Therefore, they will possess a double portion in their land. Everlasting joy will be theirs." Okay, and there are others as well that talk about these foreigners coming in and joining the people of Israel and becoming a part of the nation, but serving as servants, serving in a variety of capacities to make the society work. The place that is reserved for the people of Israel is to be the priests. And if you recall when we were going through Exodus, what God had said to Moses at Sinai was, "I will make you a nation of priests." And so apparently it's the same idea here. Israel will, the people of Israel will eventually fulfill that role of being priests to all of mankind. The people of Israel will be returned to their land and settled there in their own land. Strangers are going to join them. And these strangers are going to come from a variety of countries, but presumably even from the countries which have historically oppressed Israel. But individuals will be drawn from those countries, will come and become a part of society in Israel. And thus it can be said that they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors, in a sense. But their rule over the oppressors will not be the same as the oppressors' rule over Israel had been, that it will be a benevolent rule that these strangers will live under. Okay. Verses 3 through 11. And it will be in the day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you have been enslaved, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased and how fury has ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. They will all respond and say to you, even you have been made weak as we. You have become like us. Oh, one more. Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. So here we have this taunt being addressed to the king of Babylon. Now, I don't know what the spirit of this taunt is, whether it's in a spirit of vengeance, that there is, because of what you did to us, there's a taunt being sung by the Israelites to the king of Babylon. Now, is it because of what you have done to us, now we are rejoicing in the cruel fate that you are suffering? That's possible and understandable. But it's also possible that there's another spirit behind this, and that is justice has been done. That wickedness and wicked people have received the fate that is just and right. So not so much vengeance as a spirit of justice. In any case, this is a song that they are singing, a taunt that they are giving in a time when God has given them rest from their pains and suffering. So the pains and suffering have come to an end, and now accounts are being settled by God. That is, justice is being apportioned out. And in this justice, Babylon has, the king of Babylon is being brought down. Now, this apparently signals the end of the oppression that the Israelites have suffered. Now, the Israelites did suffer oppression at the hands of a variety of different kingdoms. Babylon was just the last. Well, I won't say it was the last, but it was the most prominent, I guess. But they had suffered at the hands of the Philistines. They had suffered at the hands of the Moabites. It goes through the Egyptians. It lists them as we go through the next few chapters. All of the nations that had at one time or another oppressed the Israelites. Now, what kind of oppression was it? I mean, if you've read in Judges, it talks about the oppression that the Israelites suffered, and there are other passages in Scripture where it talks about the oppression. And the kind of oppression that they suffered was similar to the kind of oppression that was suffered on any conquered nation in those days. A conquering nation would come in, and they would establish their rule on another people, and they would demand tribute to be paid, usually paid annually. And sometimes that was exorbitant, and sometimes it was not as exorbitant, but it was always more than they wanted to pay to a foreign country. They had to provide what is called corvée labor. Corvée labor is when a ruler says, I want you to do a certain amount of work for me. And that work could be of almost any kind. Usually it was construction, building, say, a king's palace, or building roads, or building a port, or whatever. So Israelites would be enlisted to do labor for the conquering king. And they had no choice in the matter. They had to provide that. They had to provide resources, whether it be cut stone or timber or whatever the conquering king might require. They also had to provide anything else that the king might ask for. Sometimes the king would take the sons to serve in his army, or take daughters to be in his harem or whatever. So there were a variety of ways in which suffering was inflicted upon the conquered peoples. Now, that was true of any conquered peoples. It was not just true of the Israelites. But the Israelites, Israel was never a strong country. And that's something to keep in mind. Politically speaking, Israel and Judah, speaking of both parts of the kingdom, they were never a strong nation. They were never a world power. And if you are never a world power, that means that you are vulnerable to any of the bullies around. And Israel was vulnerable to the bullies. And once conquered, you are easily conquered, and once conquered, it's difficult to throw off that yoke of servitude. So Babylon had been and became an oppressor of Israel, and inflicted those kinds of suffering on the Israelites, in addition to one other suffering, and that is taking the people of Judah into exile, taking them back to Babylon and making them live there, refusing to allow them to live in their homeland. So they had been oppressive, and what God is saying is that now, in this rest, the oppression has ceased. And it's the way it states it is how the oppressor has ceased and how fury has ceased, making it sound as if it's a sudden thing. It's certainly a noted thing. It isn't a slow cessation, but rather it's a marked change. Kind of like when you hear a loud, continuous noise over a period of time, and then it suddenly stops, and things are really quiet. The quiet can be deafening, just because you have habituated to the noise. And that, I think, that's the picture we have here. The oppression has continued, and it stops abruptly, and now it's the change is almost hard to cope with. And God has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes. So God has come down and taken the scepter of power, the symbol of authority, and broken that scepter, such that now the king who had, the king of Babylon, who had all that power, is suddenly powerless, because that power was on loan from God. And he takes the scepter and he breaks it. And no longer then can the king of Babylon wield that power oppressively as he has done up to now. He's used it, he says, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. So he has used that power wickedly, and now it's gone. God has broken that scepter. So the whole world is at rest and quiet. And they, I think that means the peoples, break forth in shouts of joy. So it's a relief to everyone that this oppressor has been, has his power broken such that he can't do it anymore. Not only do the people rejoice, but it says in verse 8, even the cypress trees rejoice. Now, Isaiah has used the symbol of trees in two or three different ways already in the chapters that we've read through. But each time he's used it to be a symbol for something different. So I don't think it has become a fixed symbol. I think here what he's talking about is, it says that the trees rejoice over you and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. In other words, these tall, majestic trees, presumably the trees of Lebanon, which were sought, highly sought by everybody in the ancient Near East, apparently the king of Babylon had been sending cutters to cut down those trees to use to build his palaces and whatever else he was building. And what is being said here is, and I think what we're supposed to understand here is he is exploiting the resources just as much as he has exploited the people of the world. That he has essentially been a raper and pillager both of peoples and of resources. And in a spirit of greed and arrogance. And now even the trees will rejoice because they are spared the cutter. So the whole world, both people and creation, rejoice at the fall of the oppressor, the king of Babylon. We've seen elsewhere in Isaiah comments about nature being out of whack under the corruption of sin. Creation itself is out of whack and has to be restored. The king of Babylon, his destination is Sheol. He will descend to Sheol. Sheol is excited to receive him, waiting eagerly for this man who is once so great to come. And all of the other dead kings, it arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. Other oppressors, maybe less successful oppressors, but nevertheless oppressors. It will raise them up to greet this fallen king because they are all sharing the same fate. And those kings are going to respond to the king of Babylon and say, even you have been made weak as we, you have become like us. So all oppressors are meeting the same fate and come down. And all of the pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. All of the accoutrements of power, all of the perks of power and the celebration of power is going to go to the same place, see the same fate. And here is a particularly disturbing image. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. What an eerie picture. Stephen King type of image. But maggots eat dead flesh. So this is a king who is nothing but a corpse, the king of Babylon. Okay, verses 11 through 23 then talk about how far he has fallen and his arrogance, the extremes of his arrogance. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened nations. And by the way, that I think that should be translated defeated nations rather than weakened. You who have defeated the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness, and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. You will not be united with them in burial, because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of the iniquity of their fathers. They must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. And I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and prosperity, declares the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog and swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. The king of Babylon had the pretense, the audacity, to want to, what's it say? He says, but you say in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. He has the pretense of being a god. It says in verse 14, I will make myself like the Most High. So he pretends to the power and the majesty of God, thinks that he is an equal to God. And it's because of that arrogance that he is going to fall so low. I can't read, I will make myself like the Most High, without thinking back to the incident in the garden, in which the serpent came to Eve and said, come on, eat. Just eat the fruit. You, because in the day that you eat of it, God knows you will be like God. That was the weak spot in mankind. That was the weak point. The weak point in mankind is we would like to be God. There is something aggravating to us in our souls that we are not God, that we are but creatures, and as creatures have quite narrow constraints on us. There is much that we cannot do, and that is very aggravating to us. And that is the impetus behind sin everywhere in all of us, is that aggravation that it is not me that rules the universe as much as I would like. And that was exactly the affliction of the king of Babylon. He wanted to rule the universe. The only problem was, it looked like he did. For him, it looked like he had substantially achieved that desire of his heart. For us, it's less clear to see that that's even attainable as we would like it to be. But for him, it appeared like he made it. But it is for that arrogance. He will go from this height of pretense, he will be plunged down into the depths of the pit, such that people will come and look at him and they'll say, you're the one? You're the one that was up there. You're the one that sat on the throne of Babylon, which ruled the world. And they'll look down at wonder because he is so insignificant. He's been reduced to nothing. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness, and overthrew its cities, who did not allow its prisoners to go home? So we're talking about a number of the forms of oppression that he inflicted on the peoples of the world. He's the one who did all of these enormous deeds. I mean, things that no one person can do, he did. And yet, now, he's been reduced to a corpse. Food, maggot food. I'm not sure what it is talking about specifically in verses 18 and 19, where it says that you will not have it. All of the other kings of the nations have a tomb, but you will not have a tomb. I'm not sure what exactly it means there, and we'll talk about this, who this king of Babylon is, in a little bit. Clothed with the slain, who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. I'm not sure who these slain are. It does say that you will not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. I'm not sure who the them is, whether it's those who were pierced with a sword or whether it's going way back up to 18, the kings of the nations. But in any case, this king will not even enjoy the satisfaction of a tomb which will memorialize him. In other words, he will not have a memory. And his sons will be put to death. Prepare his sons for a place of slaughter. So there will not be a legacy. The king of Babylon will not enjoy a legacy. Is that what they talk about with Clinton? He wants a legacy? Is that the term they use? Well, this king, the king of Babylon, will not have this legacy. And it says the sons will be put to death because of the iniquity of their father, and they must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. Now, I'll make a comment. I'll give a plug for a book here. I know Jack has mentioned it, and I have probably mentioned it as well. There's a book by Jacques Ellul called The Meaning of City. I think that's the right title. It is out of print. However, there is a copy in the University of Oregon Library. It's not a very big book, but it is a book that... Oh, and it's also hard to read. Jacques Ellul must be forgiven for the fact that he's French. And French cannot communicate, even in English. So you have to keep that in mind. But keeping that in mind, this is a fabulous book, because in the book, he traces through a city from the beginning in Genesis, when the first city is founded by Cain. He follows it all the way through and charts out what is the significance of city from the biblical perspective. And what he notices is the city becomes a symbol for the concentration of human wickedness. That there's something about the dynamic of a city. You bring people together, and he doesn't go into all of this, but my hypothesis is you create a kind of anonymity which allows people to act the way they would like to act with no repercussions. In any case, what you have in cities is the manifestation of human wickedness As a result, the Bible begins to use as the epitome of wickedness a city, Babylon. So the city throughout has the significance of this concentration of human wickedness, and that city is to be judged. What is interesting, particularly interesting, is he goes on to talk about the fact that in the new heavens and new earth, what epitomizes that new creation? It's another city. But this time it's Jerusalem. So God has taken this manifestation and creation of human wickedness, Babylon, in a sense. He takes this, the city, and then he takes this form that man has created in his wickedness, and he redeems it, and he uses it for his own purposes, Jerusalem. Now, Jacques Ellul doesn't talk about this, but there are other examples of that same kind of thing happening. Israel, when they came to the promised land, they did not have a king. But because all of the neighboring countries had a king, they asked for a king. And God said, no, don't do it. You'll be sorry if you did that. And they say, no, we've got to have a king. The neighbors have one. And God says, it's a stupid thing to do, but okay. And a king is selected. What happens with the kingship? The very thing that God predicted that the king would end up oppressing the people. And you can go down the list of things that he said will happen, and they all happened. That the kings of Israel and Judah ended up oppressing their own people, just as God had said. So there's a sense in which this institution that came into being at man's insistence worked its way out in the demonstration of the wickedness within man. But what will we have in the new heavens and the new earth? It'll be ruled by a king, by the Messiah, by Jesus. And there it will be perfect. So this institution that came into being as a result of man's wickedness is redeemed and used for God's purposes. A similar thing happens with respect to salvation and our sanctification. That what we do in our wickedness and evil works its way out. We manifest who we really are. But God steps into our lives through grace and transforms us. And part of the transformation process is drawing upon the experiences that we have had as wicked sinners. That he uses those experiences to build into us the values and the character that he wants us to have. So there seems to be this pattern, and it's a fascinating pattern. And Jacques Ellul charts this out with respect to the city. He doesn't extrapolate on it. Those are my extrapolations. But it's a very interesting book. And here, the sons of the king of Babylon are to be killed lest they possess the earth and go around building cities. Lest they go, and I think here it's cities in that sense, in the sense of creating what I talked about last week, the collective which will bring salvation to man. That if we just gather together cooperatively, we can achieve divinity as a group. Okay, so he says, I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity. Just remembering back to the Tower of Babel, what one of the things that they wanted to do was to make a name for themselves. And God is saying, no, you will not have a name. Babylon will not have a name. Babylon will not enjoy fame, only infamy. And he is going to make it a possession for the hedgehog. I don't know why the hedgehog. And swamps of water. And I will sweep it with the broom of destruction. So Babylon is going to be destroyed. I'll just read through this next section, the judgment of Assyria, and then I'll stop there. The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely just as I have intended, it has so it has happened. And just as I have planned, so it will stand, to break Assyria in my hand, in my land, and I will trample him on my mountains. Then his yoke will be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulder. This is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? Okay, so here he goes on. In 13 and 14, he has talked about Babylon and the fate that Babylon will experience. Now he turns to Assyria. He has mentioned Assyria before, and he has also proclaimed a judgment on Assyria before. But now we're going through the roll call of oppressors of Israel, and he declares a judgment on each one of them. And here he says again, Assyria is going to be broken in my land, and I will trample him on my mountains. So the ultimate defeat of Assyria then, apparently, is to be in Israel itself. And he says, surely, just as I have intended, so it has happened. He puts it in the past tense. It's as good as done. It's a done deal. This is going to come to pass. Okay, and so then the oppression will cease. The oppression that the people of Israel have experienced at the hands of Assyria will cease. Okay, I think I'll stop there. And the next, when I start teaching again, I'll pick up there and continue through the roll call of oppressors of Israel. What's going on in this section? I think that this section is really about God putting things right. And those who have been wicked, the wickedness that has been done, and those who have done the wickedness, they are going to be punished, and things will be put right. And most importantly, rightful authority is going to be reestablished. Now, a theme that I keep running into in Scripture is this concept that I call recognition of rightful authority. That is, from the very beginning in Genesis, when Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, what they were doing was rejecting the rightful authority that God the Creator had over them as His creatures. They were ignoring the authority that is there. One of the manifestations of wickedness in us and in human society is a refusal to recognize rightful authority, wherever it is. And God has established authority throughout human society. There's the authority of parents over children. There's the authority of male headship. There's authority within churches. There's authority of government, etc., etc. So God has established rightful authority. And in our wickedness, we are always wanting to invert that authority, turn it upside down. One of the manifestations of rightful authority, I think, is Israel was chosen by God to serve a unique role in the world economy. And that was as a nation of priests. and as both teachers and intermediaries on our behalf to God. They have not served that role. That's true, and that's the result of their wickedness. But we have not encouraged them in that role as well, and that is our wickedness. And in the end, that rightful order is going to be established. And Israel will serve the purpose for which God selected it out. And we will recognize the authority that God invests in them. So part of this, the peace that will come, is the erasing the chaos that we have created by our refusal to recognize rightful authority and by our arrogance and our rebellion, and establish the order as it was meant to be. Furthermore, creation itself will be restored. He's talked about that earlier, and he hints about it here, I think, with respect to the trees. So human society and human and the creation will be restored to their rightful place, to their proper place in the order of the cosmos. Furthermore, the enemies of Israel are going to be punished. Now, it's interesting, they aren't punished specifically for attacking Israel. What they are specifically punished for is their arrogance and their wickedness. But I think it is a manifestation of their arrogance and wickedness that they did attack Israel, rather than acknowledging Israel as the chosen people of God. So Israel will have its place, the wicked will be destroyed, and the rest of us will recognize Israel for what it is. It'll become the center of the world, a priesthood, and we will serve. We, as foreigners, will serve them. As a result, it will be a time of peace and order. As it talks about in verse 7, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Now, the difficult question, who is it talking about? When it talks about the king of Babylon, who is it talking about? And I don't know the answer to that question. It could be the literal king of Babylon, but it says the king of Babylon, not the kings of Babylon. So then the question is, which king of Babylon? Is it the king of Babylon when Babylon conquered Judah? Is it the king of Babylon when Babylon fell? Or does it mean the king of Babylon as an office, such that the whole line of kings of Babylon are being described here? That's possible. But again, we run into the same problem that we've encountered previously in Isaiah, and that is the language seems to be more extravagant. It seems to go beyond talking about just what was happening with Babylon at the time that Babylon fell in the 500s. So, is it talking about another Babylon to come, another king of Babylon that is yet to rise? Maybe. Or is it talking about something a little bit more abstract? And that is the spirit of Babylon. That is that spirit of oppression that is in the heart of ultimately all of us, but is also manifest in anyone in a position of power. And again, I don't know the answer to the question. We keep coming back to the same problem, and that is, to what extent is Isaiah just using poetic license? To what extent is he just using words that seem to go beyond what he is, the literal reality? And to what extent is he using these hyperbole to talk about, to hint that he's talking about something other than literally the king of Babylon. This is the last time I'm teaching for a while, so I guess I'm just going to leave that question for you guys to ponder on while I ponder on it, and then when we start in again, we can address that anew. But that's one of the main questions we have to answer here in Isaiah. When I read this, there is something really, really striking about this. Especially this chapter hit me. And the question is, do we live life with a long-term perspective or not? There's a little book that's worth reading. It's by Henry Hazlitt called Economics in One Lesson. I don't know if you've read it, but it's interesting. In it, he has several chapters, and each chapter, he talks about some commonly taught economic maxim. And he analyzes it, and in every chapter, he asks the question, is that economic principle, does it work in the long run? His point is, there are lots of economic policies that will turn benefits in the short run. Lots of them. But sound economic policy looks at the long run and says, will this turn benefits in the long run? Because if it doesn't, all we're doing is borrowing from the distant future to benefit us in the present. But sooner or later, the piper has to be paid. That's his whole point. He does that chapter after chapter after chapter. Well, the same thing could be said of living life. Are we living life for the short-term benefits, or are we living life with a long-term perspective? And one of the things that Isaiah has been pounding on is, there is a judgment coming. There is an end coming. And in the end, wickedness will be destroyed. And righteousness will be given its due. And we all, even if he's not talking in the broader sense when he talks about the king of Babylon, even if he's not talking about the oppressor in all of us, it is nevertheless true that we are all little dictators. In one way or another, we are all prone to wickedness and oppression of others. I mean, oftentimes it's in really petty ways, but we all do it. And we're all prone to that. And the question is, are we living life for the short run, or are we living life for the long run? Because if we're living life for the long run, we know what's coming. It's really hard in the short run to keep that in perspective, because wickedness pays in the short run. There's no question about it. We all know that. We've all seen it. That in the short run, you can see where there are benefits that come from doing evil things. But in the long run, it only brings death and destruction. Nothing else. I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but that hasn't stopped me from mentioning things time and time again. But there is a passage in C.S. Lewis that is truly phenomenal. And I don't even remember where it is. I know you know where it is. And when I tell them what the story is, you can tell us where it's from. But C.S. Lewis makes the comment that as we're looking out at other human beings, every human being is ultimately, in the long run, either a gross monster from whom we would turn away in disgust and horror, or they are a magnificent and glorious creature that we would be prone to fall down before and worship. If we could see their souls, peer into their souls, we would see that they are one or the other. And that with every interaction that we have with them, we are contributing to one or the other of those directions that they're going. Now, where is that, Ron? In the weight of glory. Thank you. I knew you knew it. It's a fabulous passage, and it's one that's really had a huge impact on me. As we look out, everybody it's the ugly duckling all over the place. I mean, people are not what we see. I mean, it's hard to detect what kind of soul is inhabiting each person that we're looking at. There are clues, but we can't really tell. But nevertheless, we are contributing to one fate or the other of that soul. We are either making them more beast-like, or we are making them more glorious, one or the other. And that kind of perspective, that's the long-term perspective. I think that kind of perspective is absolutely invaluable, because as we go through day by day living our mundane lives, we forget all that. That all seems to be, it's all lost on us. And yet it's true. And that's what Isaiah is talking about. There is an end coming. It doesn't look like it. It's been a long time coming, but it is coming. And in that end, wickedness will meet with death and destruction, and righteousness will be glorified. Questions or comments? We won't have much. Logan.
Who's the Byzantium king that was surrounded by such pomp and glory? Help me out here.
King of Byzantium.
Yeah.
I need another clue.
Well,
sounds like first letter.
I knew it a week ago. I'm trying to. This guy, these kings, who. No, it was after him. These guys consumed the wealth and the working energy, and they basically became the reason for the state.
Mm-hmm.
The state was their footstool. I mean, mm-hmm. it gave them their house, their power, their wealth, their glory, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pagans, right?
The Byzantines?
No, these guys here.
Yes.
The Babylonians.
Yes.
They were pagans, and they did this. They were saying, God wants, I mean, God, we're like this, whoever their God was. And by doing this, you're doing it for God. Okay. And then along come the Byzantian kings, and they do the very same thing, why they claim they're doing it in the name of the real God. They're sucking out the wealth of the nations. And I'm just thinking, just because they did that and claimed they were on God's side, what's really the difference in the psychology between them and the Babylonian kings?
Right.
Or the Vatican, yeah.
Right.
I mean, you're saying... You know what I'm saying?
Right. I think that's exactly right. It is the same spirit in both cases. One of them is rationalized, and the other one is not rationalized, at least from a Christian perspective. But the spirit is the same in both cases. Oppression is oppression.
And so, like with the Tower of Babel, it boils down to, we're going to be somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just that is so key to the temptation of Adam and Eve. You're going to be somebody.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that says that basically human civilization and human progress is fueled on idolatry. That the desire to be wealthy and in control is evil. And yet I'm surrounded by people telling me, that's the secret of life, to be wealthy and powerful and in control, to be calling the shots, to be self-employed, to control your income, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Would we laugh at Jesus if he came along and said, you know, you just need to get a job working in a hotel as a maid? It's a great job helping people, and you just stay out of the way. I mean,
yeah, I'm in sympathy with what you're saying. There's a little bit, would recommend a little caution, however, because not all independence is wrong. It's only independence from God that's wrong. And so the question is, what is the spirit behind our seeking independence from whatever? And that's what's really key. But what you say about the whole modern society and its evolution, I really think that that's what's going on in history, is that God said at the very beginning, I'm going to let man, from the time of the fall on, man, God is saying, I'm going to let man evolve society as he will. And in so doing, the character of man is going to be manifest writ large. And I think that's what we're seeing. And the driving force behind the evolution of modern society, modern culture, has been the sinfulness of man, ultimately, I think. Well, I didn't leave much time for questions, so we better quit there. Thanks.